We're actually going to not move to 5 just quite yet. I want to say a couple of things about the final part of chapter 4, and that is the power of Jesus over the sea. And in our handout from the other week, here it talks about, F talks about the kingdom of God manifest in miracles, and it starts with that incident in calming the storm. Jesus was in the boat, and the disciples, a storm comes up, as often happened and happens actually on the Sea of Galilee. It's prone to all kinds of storms just blowing up out of nowhere. And so Jesus and the disciples are there in the boat. Storm comes up out of nowhere, and they get kind of concerned. In fact, they get more than just a little concerned. And Jesus, I guess the rocking action of the boat, you know, he's asleep in the back. And here, on that day when evening had come, he said to them, starting in verse 35, "Let us go across to the other side." And leaving the crowd, they took him with them in the boat just as he was. And other boats were with him. Just as he was, that means, you know, they just traveled around, clothes on the backs, didn't stop to pack anything. He was just going to the other side for a while. Other boats were with him. In other words, people, and we find oftentimes people were trying to keep up with Jesus and following around, see what was going to happen next. And a great storm of wind arose, and the waves beat into the boat, so the boat was already filling. But he was in the stern, asleep on the cushion. And they woke him and said to him, "Teacher, do you not care if we perish?" And he awoke and rebuked the wind and said to the sea, "Peace, be still." And the wind ceased, and there was a great calm. And he said to them, "Why are you afraid? Have you no faith?" And they were filled with awe and said to one another, "Who then is this that even the wind and sea obey him?" They were wanting some kind of direction. They really didn't expect Jesus to calm the storm. They expected him to give them some kind of direction. You know, they were actually upset and worried and probably a little bit mad that he wasn't helping them. He's back there snoring away, and he wasn't helping them. But this story of, you know, reflects the power of Jesus and the disciples. It also lets us know the disciples don't understand yet. In fact, with what they've seen so far, and even with what they're going to see, they don't fully understand about Jesus and who Jesus really is. Even when Peter in Mark chapter 8 says, "You're the Christ," Jesus says, "Don't tell anybody." Why? Because they're still thinking on an earthly level, an earthly political kingdom, rather than anything beyond all of that. And here they end with a question, who in the world is this? Even the sea obeys him. The wind obeys him. You know, we've not seen anything like this. But they didn't make the connection. They hadn't connected the dots yet as to who Jesus is. But here you've got the storm that arises, and we find that the authority of Jesus from God. God creates the universe. God creates the world. God sets up all the things that go on. Even the storms and everything are part of how the world is created. And yet here Jesus proves that he's not just a miracle worker. He is Son of God, as Mark states at the very beginning. And Mark uses this story to help people understand that Jesus has the authority to even command the elements, the natural forces. Why? Because he is Son of God and because he was present in the beginning. He is Creator as well. Writer of the Gospel of John takes that even further in his prologue when he says that that the Word was with God and the Word was God, and nothing was made and nothing has light and life apart from him. So Mark is giving us that understanding here as well, that he is the one who created it, therefore he commands it. He has the authority to command it in all of this. They call him, you know, they say, "Teacher, don't you care if we perish?" The particular word for perish here doesn't just mean to die, but it means to cease to be. Period. And it actually carries with it a little bit of the Jewish ideas, for example, in in the first Psalm when it says, "For the Lord," at the end, "the Lord knows the way of the righteous, but the way of the wicked will perish." The particular word in Hebrew there means will become nothing, will cease to be. For them, that was worse than thinking about that one might be in a place of torment, was to think that I've lived this life and I've done all of this, and all of a sudden I cease to be, period. No connection with God, no connection with anything else, I just cease to be. They're expecting not just to die, but they're afraid they're going to perish, period. The disciples at this point are still functioning with that Middle Eastern idea of, even though before this point in time, there is talk within Judaism, within the Pharisees, their teachings of rewards and punishments in the afterlife, not so with the Sadducees and with some others that they're in which they're, they have contact. So, don't you care if we perish? Jesus rebukes the wind, looks at the sea and says, "Peace, be still," and suddenly the wind stops, the waves subside. And then Jesus turns to them and says, "Why are you afraid? Have you no faith?" Faith trusts God's purpose even when things can't be seen. And that's what he's asking. He said, you can't see beyond, you don't have faith, you don't trust. It's a matter of trust. Faith here is a matter of trusting God's purpose, even when you don't understand it. And whatever hardships, what he's saying is whatever hardships or whatever persecutions come, have faith. God is present. And God is faithful. St. Augustine, not the town, the person, or Augustine, as some people call him, in writing about this in one of his sermons, Augustine wrote, and he wrote about awakening the Christ asleep in you. So he took this as an allegorical kind of thing and talking about all the storms that batter us and Christ is asleep within us. We need to awaken him. Okay, we need to look for him and call upon him, not try and do it on our own. And he writes, and this is from Augustine, and rather than write it all down, I just photocopied it and cut it and tape that right there. "When you have to listen to abuse, that means you're being buffeted by the wind. When your anger is roused, you're being tossed by the waves. So when the winds blow and waves mount high, the boat is in danger. That is, your heart is imperiled. Your heart is taking a battering. On hearing yourself insulted, you long to retaliate, but the joy of revenge brings with it another kind of misfortune, shipwreck. Why is this? Because Christ is asleep in you. What do I mean? I mean you have forgotten his presence." Doesn't mean that Christ is asleep. You've forgotten his presence. "Rouse him then. Remember him. Let him keep watch within you and pay heed to him. A temptation arises. It is the wind. It disturbs you. It is the surging of the sea. This is the moment to awaken Christ and let him remind you of those words, 'Who can this be? Even the winds and the sea obey him.'" And so, Augustine, there's a lot of stuff that Augustine wrote that I don't particularly care for. But Augustine says here, Christ is, if we are his followers, he is within us. The Spirit is within us. He is within us. Christ within you, the hope of glory. But oftentimes, he's quote unquote asleep. In other words, we forget his presence is there and we don't call on him. And so he said, when trials come, when things happen that disturb us, that threaten us and threaten shipwreck in our lives, that's the time to remember that he's there and to call upon him. And then remember, he calmed the sea, he calmed the winds, he did other things, he can do the same for us. And so Jesus does this and they begin to wonder about him. And about that time, and once again, this is Mark, everything happens almost immediately, one thing right after the other. If you were to take, as we said that first night, if you were to take Jesus' ministry in the Gospel of Mark time frame, you could condense everything into 9 months rather than the 3 years that John indicates and that we find a long period, longer than 9 months in Matthew and Luke. So Mark's just fast-paced. But then again, remember, Mark's writing for people who are under persecution in Nero's Rome and who don't know when their next breath is going to end or if they're even going to get it. They come to the other side of the sea, to the country of the Gerasenes, or Gadarenes, or Gergesenes. Different Greek texts have different words. But it is on the other side of the lake. It is over near the Decapolis. The Decapolis were 10, in the northeastern corner of the area, were 10 cities predominated by Gentiles, Greeks. Deca, 10, Polis, city-state, the Decapolis. It was an area with 10 small towns and cities that were populated primarily by Greeks and other Gentiles. Not very many Jews in that particular area. And so they get to the other side of the sea. And it's interesting, Jesus actually, according to Mark, Jesus is intentionally, when they leave on one side, he's not planning on going somewhere else. He's got them headed straight for this area of Gentiles. So in the Gospels, you know, we think Jesus comes for the Jews. He comes for, yes, he does. But we also find very early on in his public ministry, Jesus ministers to anybody, not just Jews. And here he's on his way to minister to Gentiles. And so he comes. There are a few Jews that live in that area, but not. It's predominantly Gentiles. They come to the other side, or came to the other side of the sea, the country of the Gerasenes. Not the garrisons of Gerasenes. And when he had come out of the boat, there met him out of the tombs a man with an unclean spirit who lived among the tombs. And no one could bind him anymore, even with a chain. For he had often been bound with fetters and chains, but the chains he wrenched apart, the fetters he broke in pieces, and no one had the strength to subdue him. Night and day among the tombs and on the mountains, he was always crying out and bruising himself with stones. In other words, he was screaming and hollering, and he threw himself against rocks, stones, all, and he lived in the tombs. He is, you know, this guy is about as unclean as you can get. Okay? He's demon-possessed. He lives among the dead, so he's unclean there. He's demon-possessed, so he's unclean. He lives among the dead in the tombs, so he's even more unclean there. There's no way he could begin to even participate in religious ritual. He is so unclean. And so notice we've got this man coming to Jesus. Jesus doesn't go seek him out. He comes to Jesus. And once again, in the Gospel of Mark, most of the healings that take place is somebody that has come to him, whether they know they want to be healed or not. Or somebody brings them to Jesus. And Jesus heals, not to elicit faith and belief, but Jesus heals in response to that. Even this demoniac who comes out seeking Jesus, some scholars have said, you know, that's evidence. You know, you sometimes watch these horror movies and things, and, you know, and like Michael Myers in Halloween, you know, he's after his sister and all, and she says, I know you're still in there somewhere, Michael. You're still in there somewhere. Or there'll be, you know, taken over. One of these horror movies, somebody will be taken over by a demon, and that demon's really wrenching them and hurting other people, and they're about to kill heroine in the thing, or one of the main characters, and typically it's a woman or a young girl, and I know you're in there. I know you're in there somewhere. Come on, I know you're in there somewhere. And they'll kind of come to the surface and get away, and then, yeah, that kind of thing. Well, it's almost like this. The guy, even though he has for years been this way, and he has for years been living among the tombs and tormented and tortured, there's still a little something in there that draws him to Jesus. The demons aren't wanting to get out, but there's still something left of the man, which also is a way, I think, for Mark to say that, too, that within these Christians, no matter what you face, no matter what may seem to be going on, no matter how horrible things may seem to be and how horrible you may seem to feel and be, somewhere in there, there's still that semblance, that little piece of you that longs for God's presence in spite of the demons, in spite of the head spinning around. And when he saw Jesus from afar, he ran, and my text says he ran and worshipped him. Actually, the text says that that he runs and proskunine, two words that literally mean to kiss before. It's used when someone falls on their knees or their face in front of a superior or a god. They recognize they're in the presence of a superior or a God, and their immediate reaction is to fall down on their face. That's what he does. He runs up to Jesus when it says worshiped him here. Literally, he runs up to Jesus and he falls down prostrate on his face. Recognizing this. He does. And well, the demons are talking to him, but Jesus senses deep down inside there's still a piece of the man's spirit that needs to be released from this. And that is not the demons. It's that little piece of that man, which then once again goes on to say, no matter what you're facing, no matter what's going on, you know, if you sincerely go, God's there wanting to help you and ready to help you. And so this, you know, the demoniac comes running up to him instead of screaming and spitting and cursing and all that kind of stuff and cries out with a loud voice. So he falls down in front of him. That's a recognition, not only by the man, but even the demons recognize the superiority of Jesus. Even the superiors, they recognize the superiority of Jesus. And he screams out at the top of his lungs in front of everybody, "What have you to do with us?" Now, once again, Jesus makes them be quiet as far as telling people who he is. But, "What have you to do with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? I adjure you by God, do not torment me." Now, Son of the Most High God would have been a typical kind of, it's not a designation for the Messiah within the Gentile world at this time. You're the Son of the Most High God, which means there are other lesser gods. Well, within most Gentile religions, Roman, Greek, Egyptian, etc., you've got levels of gods. Some of them were very polytheistic. Some of them were henotheistic. And actually, even up until the time of David, the Jews were henotheistic. That is, God, Yahweh, is the superior God, the only one that we worship, but we're not sure whether these other ones exist or not, so we're not going to say they don't, but that's the one we're going to worship and follow. That's henotheism. You believe in and worship one God as supreme while not denying the possible existence of lesser gods. And even David in some of the Psalms says, "You are Lord and God above all other gods." Well, here, a typical Gentile reaction is, there are a lot of gods out there, but you are the Son of the Most High, not just a high God, but the one that is above all others. And so there's that recognition of divinity within Jesus, notice by a Gentile who is demon-possessed. They know who Jesus is. They know who Jesus is. But it's kind of interesting and ironic. These demons who have been tormenting and torturing this guy for years, and what do they say? "I beg you, please don't torment us." You know, please don't, and the word means to torment or to torture or to harass. They said, "Don't harass us. Don't torture us. Don't torment us." Yeah. Now, Jesus could very well looked at him and said, "Wait a minute. This is worse than a pot calling a kettle black. Yeah. Here, you're going to get yours." But he says, "Don't do that. For he had said to him, 'Come out of the man, you unclean spirit.'" So Jesus asked, "What is your name?" Notice, he said to the man, "Come out, unclean spirit." The spirit doesn't leave. This is the one incident where Jesus will demand that spirits leave, and they don't immediately leave. And so here in Mark, Jesus says, "Okay, what is your name?" The belief in the ancient world was if you knew the name of a demon or the name of an angel or a name that characterized the inmost, most sacred part of a god or spirit, then you could have some control over them. And so when he says, "Come out of the man," and they don't, then the next step is you ask the name, and once you get the name, then you can have power and control. That's why when Moses tells God, "Well, you know, we hadn't heard from you, seen from you in a long time, appreciate all this stuff, but if I go back and say the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob sent me, they're not going to believe it, they're going to laugh at me." He's not counting on God giving him any kind of other name, because supposedly you can control the gods that way. And God said, "Well, just give him my sacred names. Tell him Yahweh sent me." Moses didn't want to hear that. But, you know, that was, but God knew that he couldn't be controlled by that. So he says, use this. Well, it's the same thing here. What's your name? And he replies, my name is Legion, for we are many. Which emphasizes the power and the authority of God over not just the sea and the waves, not just a demon, but we've got legion. Anybody know how many legion would be? It's based on the Roman legions. 5,000. 5,000 was the typical Roman legion. Of course, and that was divided into all kinds of different levels. But now that doesn't mean there are 5,000 demons in him, but that emphasizes there are lots and lots and lots and lots and lots of demons inside this guy. When he says, my name is Legion, that word is based on, and that the concept that this guy's not just possessed by one, two, or three, innumerable spirits. Because the Roman Legion was 5,000 soldiers. Well, now he's given a name so the demons know, uh-oh, we slipped up and gave him a name, so he's going to get rid of us. So the power of Jesus over that. He's going to get rid of us. And so what do they do? It was enough. They said, you know, don't torture and torment us. Uh-oh, we gave up that name. And he begged them eagerly not to send them out of the country. He said, don't send us away into oblivion. Let us hang around here. Oh, by the way, the guy says, see all those pigs over there? Send us into the pigs or the swine. Let us enter them. So he gave them leave, and the unclean spirits, plural, came out and entered the swine, and the herd, numbering about 2,000, took off. And they rushed down the hill, and they jump in the ocean and drown. I mean, he did what they said. They said, don't send us out of the country. But the really ironic thing is here, you know, he grants their request not to send them out of the country, but it also shows that how destructive evil can be, and sometimes it's self-destructive. In this particular instance, it's self-destructive. The spirits don't know, and the pigs run into the sea. They not only destroy themselves, but they destroy the demons. It would have been better for them to have cast them out of the country. Instead, now they cease to be. They cease to exist. Now, the reaction of the pigs, Jesus gets rid of the unclean spirits of the man. He gets rid of the unclean pigs because they run into the sea and drown. All this kind of stuff. The reaction, or the part of the reason that Mark includes what happened with the pigs, the swine, is so that people can't say, well, you know, nothing really. How do we know the demons came out of the man? This gives evidence, and there were witnesses, not only the pig farmers, the pig herders, but others, disciples and others who saw this. So it confirms that, yes, an exorcism did take place. Because all of a sudden, this man goes into his right mind, and the pigs go crazy and run away and kill themselves. And it also shows Jesus' power over the demons and Jesus getting rid of the unclean spirits and the unclean pigs. Well, the reaction, the pig farmers are afraid. Now, they wouldn't have been Jewish. They were Gentiles. So their reaction to this display of power by a deity is to flee. What if he does something to us now? Because we're Gentiles and we had pigs. And so they flee. And in the city and in the country, they begin telling people what happened. I mean, you see the pigs. Everybody knew these guys had thousands of pigs. And all of a sudden they come running into town scared to death and across the countryside scared to death and without the pigs. Well, what happened? And this guy out here put something into pigs and they ran into the sea and drowned. So what's the reaction of people when they hear something like that? What's the reaction of people when they hear there's been a bad accident? Really? They not only will rubberneck, some of them, and not just ambulance chasing lawyers, some of them, they hear about it on the TV or whatever, somebody calls them and said, you ought to see, and they show them a picture on the cell phone, they got to go and see. Yeah, we're drawn to that kind of like a moth to the flame. Of course, that doesn't work out too well for the moth most of the time. And so the people came to see what happened. They couldn't believe it. They had to see for themselves. And got all the pigs floating around dead in the water. They came to Jesus, and when they got there, before they even saw the pigs, what do they see? The man. And how is he acting? Yeah, he's acting normal. He hadn't acted normal in years, and all of a sudden he's acting normal. He didn't even get kicked in the head by a mule. Movie reference. Anybody tell me what that movie reference is to? National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation. The little girl, and when they show up unexpectedly, they're living in the RV, and they show up unexpectedly, and Peggy Sue or whatever, and says, "Oh, her eyes aren't crossed anymore." Doris Roberts says that, and what's his face? I can't even remember his name now. But the actor that played his Clark's brother says, "Well, yeah, go figure." Falls down a well, eyes go crossed, gets kicked in the head by a mule, they straighten out. Yeah. What? Yes, Randy Quaid. Thank you. Yeah. So they come running to see, and a demoniac is sitting there in his right mind. Everything's fine. He hadn't been in his right mind since they knew. He's sitting there. He's clean. He's changed his clothes. Instead of rags, he's wearing clean clothes, and he's sitting there in his right mind. Everything's fine. Which once again says something about the power of Jesus over those forces, the forces of evil. And those, you know, their reaction, well, they got afraid. Wait a minute, we're not one of his followers. He did that to this guy and to the pigs. What are we going to do to us? They're afraid. And those who had seen it told what had happened to the demoniac and to the swine. And so, this is one of the few times where people don't want Jesus around. I mean, you think, hey, it did. Hey, let's go get Aunt so-and-so. She can throw a cane away and not ever have to use it again. Yeah. Bring her on. Mm-mm. This time, I said, no. We don't want you around here. And so they beg Jesus. It's interesting. The demons beg Jesus not to send them away from the country, and these folks beg Jesus to leave. After what they see. You know, this miracle is confirmed by all kinds of witnesses, and yet they want Jesus to go. Well, they're not sure what's going on, and just like the Pharisees had said earlier, he's in league with the devil. They're not sure. And they're afraid what might happen. They're also probably afraid that if they keep him around, that maybe the Romans or somebody else will come in and create problems for him.
Hey, let me ask something kind of a little bit. When you talked about going across, going to Greek place and everything else, what was the Romans' relationship with the Greeks? Were they at peace, or were they still trying to conquer each other?
The Romans conquered Palestine in 63 B.C. Under Roman general Pompey. And he was pretty pompous too. But after they did that with Pompey, they had conquered the Achaean Empire as well. You know, Alexander died long before that, but they conquered the Achaean Empire as well. They were, even though the Greeks had a thriving economy, they still had to do obeisance to the Romans. The Romans had the power. Yes, at that time, the Romans had the power and authority. They were part of the Roman Empire. Yeah, they were part of the Roman. The Roman legions marched and held sway even in Greece at this point. They say, "Get out of here, please." So Jesus decides to oblige them. And as he's getting into the boat, the man who had been possessed with demons comes up and begs him to take him along. "Let me go with you." One of the things in Mark shows rather regularly, this whole fear. Fear in the Gospel of Mark is one of the signs that people either have an inadequate faith or they don't have faith at all. The reaction to Jesus of fear shows either no faith, or more times than not in the Gospel of Mark, it shows an inadequate faith. One that only wants what they want and doesn't understand anything bigger. anything greater. And so Jesus goes to get in a boat, and a man begs, "Let me go with you." Why? That he might be with him. That's not just to travel around with him, but he wants to follow him and learn from him and do whatever Jesus wants him to do. His reaction to this and to this grace that he has been shown is, "I want to do everything I can to be whoever you want me to be. Whoever you need me to be." But Jesus refused and said to him, "Go home to your friends." In other words, Jesus said, "If you want to really be what I need for you to be, go home and tell your friends what happened. Go home and tell your friends that you saw God's mercy, that it was shown to you. Go home to your friends." Notice he says, start with your friends, not with strangers. "And tell them how much the Lord has done for you and how he has had mercy on you." This is one of the few places where we find Jesus using the term Lord to refer to himself. But that lordship that he's referring to is the lordship of God. This mercy, this care, all of this came from God. "And he went away and began to proclaim in the Decapolis how much Jesus had done for him, and all men marveled." Jesus commissions a man, go and tell. He goes, and the word, when it says he proclaimed, the word is kerusine, from which we get kerygma, which means preach and proclaim. So the man basically functioned like, and it's the same word when Jesus commissions his disciples to go and to teach and preach. It's the same word, kerusine. To share the kerygma, the gospel, the Christian message. Charisma comes from charis, which is grace. Kerygma is to proclaim or preach a message. What? Yes. Yes. And, you know, when it talks about being charismatic, that means that someone is actively preaching the gospel or the good news. Charismatic means that they've got this grace gift that is being exercised. And so he begins to preach. Notice, not in to the Jews in the Jewish cities. He goes back to the Decapolis and starts telling Greeks who believe all these other gods what has happened and who he understands Jesus to be and what Jesus has done. So it's interesting that really among the first people that are commissioned to go out and to teach the good news of God and the kingdom in Jesus are not Jews, they're Gentiles. They're Gentiles. But that is what all the disciples are supposed to do, not only the 12, but all who become disciples, followers. "And when Jesus crossed again in a boat to the other side, a great crowd gathered about him, and he was beside the sea." And so he comes back across. Okay? "Then came one of the rulers of the synagogue," or leaders of the synagogue, "Jairus by name, and seeing him," what does he do? Falls at his feet. Recognition of superiority. "And he besought him," that is, he begged him, he pleaded with him, "saying, my little daughter is at the point of death. Come and lay your hands on her so that she may be made well and live. And he went with him. And a great crowd followed him and thronged about him. And there was a woman who had a flow of blood for 12 years." This kind of interrupts, but they're on the way there. Flow of blood for 12 years. "And who had suffered much under many physicians." Does that mean that she had suffered, but the physicians couldn't help her, but the physicians brought suffering on her? Either way, sometimes physicians bring suffering. But she had been suffering, and she got no better. Everything gets worse. What's really interesting is both of these females are considered unclean. She, because of the flow of blood. Jairus' daughter, because she's going to be a corpse. Jairus' daughter is how old?
12 years old.
How long has this woman been sick? 12 years. And so there are all kinds of connections here that in this process, this woman who has had, she's lived a long life so far, but she's had this disease for 12 years and is considered unclean. She can't go near anything holy. She can't worship, all this kind of stuff. Jesus is going to take care of that and give and restore her life to what it was before. Here's this 12-year-old girl who dies at age 12, and Jesus restores her life to what it was before. So they're linked together here. And it also shows in Mark, you know, we talk about Luke talking about the outcasts and especially women and the elevation of women. Here in Mark, we find Jesus didn't just come to heal the men, doesn't just come to teach the men. Jesus comes to heal anybody, including women. And we know what happens. She's heard reports about Jesus, and she comes sneaking up behind him. She says, I'm not supposed to be, but if I can just touch his robe. And she touches his robe. He feels power leave, and she is healed. And then Jesus turns around and says, all right, who touched me? I said, wait a minute, we got all this crowd. What do you mean? Touched you. Everybody's jostling. No, I felt the power leave. Who touched me? And it's almost like the parting of the Red Sea. She comes forward and sheepishly, and the people part. But see, it's important. It's important in the writer of the Gospel of Mark's mind. It's important to show that Jesus needed to make contact with that person so that people knew it wasn't just some magical formula or something, and that they could just on a whim get whatever they needed. He confronts her. She's afraid, and she falls down before him and fesses up. And he said, daughter, notice, your faith has made you well. Go in peace and be healed of your diseases. Once again, reaction to her faith. So Jesus heals this woman. Jesus has power over disease. He's got power over the sea and the wind and other things. He's got power over the demonic evil forces. He's got power over diseases. Not just mental diseases, but physical diseases. Now comes the biggie. By the way, Jairus is the leader of the synagogue. He was not the chief rabbi. He was in an elite group of laypersons who were chosen to lead worship, meetings for worship. It was they who decided on the spot who would read Scripture, who would read the prayers, and it was they who would turn around and say to either the person reading Scripture, okay, you can comment on Scripture, or he might turn and say, call someone else out and say, would you like to comment on the Scriptures? So he had that kind of authority. He's not the head priest, but he's still a biggie in the synagogue. For him to come to Jesus, this leader in the synagogue, with everything that was going on, he would not have found friends in the Sanhedrin. Even at this point. Why? Because he's going against them and finding Jesus. So while he was still speaking, and I'm sure Jairus is with him, and all this goes on, and I'm sure he's standing there. While they're there, a runner comes up with what message? Your daughter is dead. So why bother him anymore? It's too late. So he wanted him to come. Once again, Jesus has been healing diseases, so they thought, well, he'll come and heal the disease, everything will be fine. Now she's dead. She's dead. We've confirmed she's dead. We've already called an undertaker. You know, all this kind of stuff. Don't even bother. Let him go on about his business. But ignoring what they said, Jesus says, let's go. Don't be afraid, only believe. When they get there, he allows no one to follow him except Peter, James, and John, the brother of James. When they come to the house of the ruler of the synagogue, he saw a tumult. In other words, people everywhere. I mean, the word has spread quickly. This was a well-known guy and a well-liked guy in the community, and people are coming out of the woodwork to mourn, to offer support. to bring, probably to bring lentil soup and all of Klein's. See, those were the forerunners of Baptists that think we, you know, when something happens to somebody, we got to feed them. So, now they show up, a tumult. That means there's a bunch of people and everything is in an uproar. There is wailing and moaning and all this kind of stuff. And people weeping and wailing loudly. When he had entered, he said to them, "Why do you do all this? Why are you making such a fuss? Why are you people making such a fuss? Child's not dead. She's just sleeping." And they laughed at him, and he sent them all outside. Well, some of them laughed at him, I'm sure, and some of them probably were just like, you know, I've often said there were probably people in the crowd when Jesus goes to raise Lazarus, and they go, you know, "Take me to the tomb," and then he cries, and there are people asking if he really cared about him, why didn't he come keep him from dying? And then he says, he has the audacity to say, "Okay, open up the tomb." And I guarantee you there were people thinking, "How cruel can you be? You got the family here, they've been mourning. How cruel can you be to say, let's open up the tomb?" Well, I'm sure there were people that laughed at him and said, "You don't know what you're talking about. You weren't here." And there probably some of them think, "Wait a minute, how cruel can you be?" And so Jesus sends everybody outside and they go into the room. Just Peter, James, John, Jairus and his wife and Jesus. And the little girl. Taking her by the hand. They're sitting there, they're crying, they're standing there crying. What in the world? Taking her by the hand, he said to her, "Talitha kumi, little girl, arise." Little girl, arise. And immediately, once again, there's that word from Mark. Wasn't, okay, let's watch, let's wait. Jesus didn't have to do it two or three times. He simply says, "Little girl, arise." And immediately the girl got up and walked. She was 12 years of age. And they were immediately overcome with amazement. I imagine it's more than just amazement. I imagine those parents were more, it was something more than just being amazed. The girl was dead. Now she's alive, which shows in all of this, Jesus has power over the storm. Jesus has power over the demons. Jesus has power over diseases, mental and physical. And Jesus has power over death. He is Son of God who has power of life and death. He has restored life to the woman by taking care of that flow of blood and healing her of all diseases. And it's done in front of witnesses. He restores life to the little girl and to her family. Let's not forget them in all of this, where there was none. And so in Mark, the end of chapter 4 through chapter 5 is this display of Jesus' power. Not a magician. Not somebody that just wanted to play Caesar's palace, very literally. But who had genuine power and genuine authority. Why? Because as Mark says at the beginning, it's the gospel of Jesus Christ who is Son of God.
Is this before or after the rise of Lazarus?
This is before. Well, this would be before Lazarus, before Jesus is as well known. And remember, they're only Peter, James, John, Jairus, and his wife in there with Jesus and the little girl. Whereas raising Lazarus, you got all these, and Lazarus has been dead for 4 days.
But when that happened, no one really remembers or knew of these events that much.
Well, they told the stories, but. Since it wasn't a large crowd to witness and all this other kind of stuff, it just kind of, okay, that's a rumor. That's, you know, that's one of these nice stories out here, but let's see what else he can do. And that's why the crowds kept following. What else can he do? What else can he do? What else can he give us? And he says here, charge them that no one should know this and told them to give her something to eat. Well, it's kind of tough that people don't know that she's alive. But you're right, Jerry. It says that. But what I think he means there, and is how has he done this? He says, Talitha Kumi, little girl, arise. He doesn't want somebody running. I think what he's saying, don't tell them how this happened. Don't tell them what I said, how I did it. Because later on, when Simon Peter is in the house of Dorcas, who is dead, and they leave him alone with this woman. Dorcas's name is also what?
Tabitha.
And he goes in there and he's praying and he's saying, oh God, what am I going to do? And the text says suddenly he looks at the woman and he says, Tabitha Kum. Talitha Kumi. Tabitha Kum. And she wakes up. And so Jesus, I think, was saying here, don't tell them how this happened, because then people might run around thinking, oh, this is some kind of hocus-pocus, abracadabra formula that we can speak and we can do all kinds of great and wonderful things, and then maybe we'll get invited to play Caesar's Palace. So I think he did charge them not to, but it's kind of tough when she's dead and now she's alive. But I do think, Jerry, what he's trying to say here is, and this is part of Messianic secret, don't tell people how it happened. Because the whole town's going to buzz about this one. Little girl's dead, and now she's walking around playing and all that kind of stuff. Of course, you know, in her case and with Lazarus, too. Of course, they wouldn't think about it, but with Lazarus as well. It's kind of like, and I can't remember her name, but the one I've told y'all before that Tom said, the woman that, the older woman around here, church member that died, and the doctors got her back. And when she said, yeah, what happened? Well, you died, but we worked on you, we got you back. And her reaction was, well, why did you do that? Now I just got to go and do it all over again. Yeah. Well, they both had to do it all over again at some point. It wasn't Mama Ree, it was somebody else. I think it's the woman that he said went ahead and paid him in for her funeral services in pecans and thought that she'd wasted those pecans because now she's come back. But I can't remember who he says. So she had a bunch of pecan trees and she gave him a whole bunch of pecans. He's told me that story several times. But she did. She wanted to know now, wait a minute, I gave you all these pecans and what am I going to do? Yeah, it's a waste of pecans. Yes.
Do you think that people actually can do this without any supervision? And not tell anybody?
The thing is,
does it have to happen the way the Bible says it should?
Well, if Jesus does it, yes. But then what happens? Nobody pays attention, because when he heals a leper, he says in Mark chapter 1, he says, "Now go, show yourself to the priests. Do the proper sacrifice, but don't tell anybody who did this." And the first thing he does is he grabs the sacrifice and says, "I'm going to do this, but guess what? Jesus did this to me." And the text says that his fame spread, so they started bringing him all these people. He healed Peter's mother-in-law, made him happy, so she'd go home. Healed Peter's mother-in-law, and they start bringing him, after the Sabbath's over, they start bringing him all kinds of folks. And the text says that his fame spread. And specifically, after the leper, his fame spread so that he could no longer openly enter a town. Yeah. Because every time he got anywhere near a town, word got out and people were waiting for him and lining the streets like a parade when he walked in.
But in our present time, do you think things happen this way, but it's just not spoken?
Well, I think sometimes it does, but I also think that more healing...
I
think some of that probably does, but I think that more healing takes place through the skills and the work that God works through doctors and nurses and others than these other things. But then again, you end up with somebody that's got a cancer diagnosis, and then they go back 2 weeks later and have another CT and have not had a single treatment. It's no longer there, and they can't explain it. I think they confirmed she was dead.
Yes, sir.
And so I'm sure they didn't do some of the tests they do these days to do brain death. But I think there were probably some that doubted, just like there were some that doubted with the raising of Lazarus. And some of them immediately ran to tell the religious leaders about it, and they said, oh, hold on, we let him keep doing this. Romans are going to destroy us, put us out of a job. We destroy the temple, put us out of a job. We need to have him killed. In fact, he didn't come up riding on a white horse and get off and give her a kiss and wake her up. He went away from there and came to his own country, and his disciples followed him. And on the Sabbath, he began to teach in the synagogue. Many who heard him were astonished, saying, "Where did this man get all this? What's the wisdom given to him? What mighty works are wrought by his hands?" I mean, they already knew what was going on. They were hearing this stuff by the time he gets back to his hometown. And then they say, is not this the carpenter, the son of Mary, and brother of James and Joseph and Judas and Simon, and are not his sisters here with us? And they took offense at him. They said, wait a minute, we know this guy. Now, the same account in the Gospel of Matthew, is not this the carpenter's son, and are not his brothers here with us, etc. But it's the same thing. They said, wait a minute, he's just a carpenter. He wasn't trained. How did he get all this stuff? And they take offense at the fact that he's there and that he's been doing these things and he's been teaching. And they think, they really get to thinking, you know, he's going to look down on them. They took offense, and Jesus' reaction, a prophet is not without honor. I mean, he's rejected here. A prophet is not without honor, except in his own country, among his own kin and in his own house. And he could do no mighty work there except he laid his hands upon a few sick people and healed them. Now that doesn't mean he couldn't do work there, but that means only a few people came to him and trusted in him and he healed them because of their faith, but everybody else doubted. Therefore, he didn't do a bunch of healing there because they wouldn't come to him and believe in him. It's not that he was restricted and could not. It's he didn't. He healed those that came with faith, but other people didn't, and so he could only do a few things there. And he marveled because of their unbelief. He marveled because of their unbelief. He's rejected at Nazareth, his hometown, and he is shocked. Yeah, I mean, y'all know me. I grew up here. You know the kind of life I've lived. You hear these things, they're true, and you still won't believe just because you've known me since I was knee-high to a pup. So once again, it's an inadequate faith. It's a lack of faith and an inadequate faith. Jesus could not or did not do those healings. He could do no mighty work there. Why? Not because he didn't have the power to, but because people didn't believe him and they didn't come. Therefore, they didn't get the power. They didn't get the mighty works done. Which then indicates, once again, that without faith and without acting upon that faith and that belief, we don't receive what we're supposed to and what we can.
Is that the same? Because wasn't the mother and father, I guess, I mean, that part confuses me. They knew who he was.
But even Mary, the text says, kept things in her heart. Luke says that Mary would keep things in her heart, even though she knew, you know, and she had all that kind of stuff. Why would she want him to get so popular that perhaps the Romans would kill him? She didn't want that to happen. Yeah. Trying to keep him out of harm's way.
Is that Mother Mary?
Yes. Yes.
Mother.
Even words of wisdom, let it be. She said, just let it be. Well, that clock says 1 till and mine says 1 after, so we'll split the difference and say it's 7 o'clock. God bless you. Go in peace, and next week we'll move forward in chapter 6.